Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves and today we are talking, I'm going to steal the phrase, death by a thousand cuts and a vortex of inaction. Speaking of someone who does very little, Martin, how are you keeping?
I grow, Tony. I just grow. That's what I do. And about growth, we want to put out loads of these podcasts. We're working very hard on it. The schedule for the next month, I'm going to rob a Trumpism. Unbelievable. You just wouldn't believe it.
Oh, God.
So, Anyway, please stick your hand in your pocket and become a subscriber, become a patron, patreon.com/tortoiseshack. The more, the merrier. Thanks very much.
Some more housekeeping. The live shows that have gone ahead every Sunday now are continuing to grow. If you are a Patreon supporter, you do get a link, you do get access, you get to come along, and then there's the last 20 minutes where we just open up the mics and all hell breaks loose. It's a great bit of crack, and everybody's enjoying it on the Sunday. I do want to say a big thank you for all the support for my run at the weekend. I completed the 2020 miles, and we've raised now over €8,500 for Inner City Helping Homeless and Anna Liffey. We will be keeping the donation buttons open for those process up until next Tuesday, which means anything you chip in towards the Tortoise Shack for the next week will go to those two charities. None of it will go to the Tortoise Shack. All the proceeds are going to the two charities. So if you were thinking of supporting me, you still have a few days to do it. Please do. Anyway, enough self-praise. Delighted to be joined on the line, rejoined on the line by investigative journalist and reporter at Noteworthy, Niall Sargent. Niall, how are you?
Good. Thanks for having me on again, guys.
Great to talk to you. Haven't seen you in a while. We were last time. Jesus, it must be nearly this time last year since we were able to actually have a beer and see each other in person. But nonetheless, you've been a busy boy. The forestry, I'm going to say the two pieces that you've done, they're some of the best investigative journalism done on any topic, just the depth of stuff you went into. Do you want to give the listeners an idea of what's in the actual, just a broad outline, and then obviously they can go and read the articles afterwards. You have to read them, folks.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate those kind words, and I have not paid you for them. That's very organic. Thank you very much. I think this is my third investigation I worked on since I joined Noteworthy earlier this year, and it's probably the one going into it that I knew the most on from my previous work with the Green News and focusing on environmental and climate issues for a few years. So I think most people don't know a huge amount about forestry in Ireland. That's unlike a lot of other countries in Europe, the vast majority of our forestry is plantation forestry, and plantation forestry with introduced non-native species. Conifers, which is about 50% of the entire planting in Ireland, is Sitka spruce, which grows more organically, let's say, in the north of America, but not so much here. But it's a fast growing, what's seen as a crop more so than actually what you would think as a forest, let's say. So we examined the forestry plantation model in Ireland, looking specifically at the biodiversity and environmental impacts. So to do this, I think a lot of the commentary, as anyone has seen lately, has been focused on the backlog in forestry, in the timber production side of things. And there are genuine issues there, but no one's really peeled back so much the issues around the environmental side of it, because that has played a big, big role in the blockage. And what we uncovered was that the sort of the big issue that's causing the backlog is that the Forest Service, which sits under the Department of Agriculture, has not been carrying out all of its environmental assessments appropriately, let's say, or it's been deemed that they haven't been appropriate by this body called the Forestry Appeals Committee, which deals with people bringing appeals against licenses to try to get them quashed for putting up new forestry or for taking down trees. So a lot of the decisions that are coming back now is that the environmental assessments that were done in that regard for the licenses were not carried out exactly in line with European environmental law, which is a big, big issue. So there's this massive backlog now. I think what we did, maybe that was a bit fresh, was we looked through, and it took quite a bit of time, was looking through the actual license application. So we sent a lot of accessed information on the environment requests, which is I know you guys have talked a lot, but for anyone who doesn't know, it's similar to freedom of information requests, but specifically for environmental issues. We got back data on over 30,000 license applications, put them in order, had a look through, compared this with the cases of the appeals and the appeals committee, and obviously spoke with ecologists, experts, people within the forestry sector, people within the conservation NGO world, legal experts as well, academics, to piece together what are the main environmental impacts of our plantation model, and focus more on that administrative side, like I said, to see, okay, has the government, has the state been carrying out their environmental assessments appropriately before granting these licenses? And the information that comes back is showing that in a lot of cases, not necessarily.
Not necessarily. I think there was it right in saying there was like two?
So the environmental impact. So there's essentially, this is why I've tried to distill, it's a little complicated, we try to distill as much as possible. So when you're coming out of Europe, there's obviously different legislation, there's the directives coming out, there's a lot of environmental law that comes from Europe that we have to implement here in Ireland. Essentially, you have no choice, you have to follow as clear to the ruling from Europe and out of case law from the European Court of Justice as possible. In line with the European law, there's two different key types of environmental assessments. So there's one called appropriate assessment, which is when you're close to these protected nature sites. So they can be protected for different flora and fauna. It can be, you know, species of snail in some cases, all the way up to protection for raptor, important raptor species like the hen harrier and the freshwater pearl mussel that we examine both species in this. So for that, that's the appropriate assessment. That's when it's within a certain distance of these protected areas, you have to screen. That's the first step. So you screen to see if there's going to be an impact. And then if you cannot disprove that there will not be an impact, you're supposed to do a full appropriate assessment, which is a much more detailed analysis. And it's very, very strict. Like I said, if you cannot prove scientifically beyond a reasonable doubt that there will not be an impact on these species, you should be carrying out. There have been very few appropriate assessments carried out up until recently. And the main reason now they're starting to be carried out, the full assessments, is because of those cases that went to the appeals committee that are now being, they're overturning the licenses. So the Forest Service and the department have had to change the process. The other one is the environmental impact assessment, which is what you're referring to, Tony, that there has only been, from the data we've seen, there's only been three carried out on 17,000 afforestation license applications over the last 10 years. The reason they're important is because they apply to any location across the country. So it's not only close to protected areas that you have to carry it out. I think if anyone's looked at a planning application, oftentimes now there is an environmental impact assessment report that's carried out by the person who's applying for the planning permission. And sometimes they're 100, 200, 300 pages, because you're looking at the environmental impacts, but you're also looking at the social impacts as well and the climate impacts. So you're talking about, you know, looking at pollution, noise pollution, the impact on people living close to the proposed development. So it's a wide ranging one. And I know it sounds, we have to put the caveat, it sounds extreme that only three were carried out. We go into this in detail, particularly in the first, but also in the second article. The key reason why they're not being carried out is because there is this threshold for forestry of 50 hectares when you're mandated to carry out an environmental impact assessment. The problem there is that the average size of a license application for afforestation is about 8 hectares at the moment. So there's none of those that are going to be falling under it. There is something in Irish regulations which say that if it's found that there could be an impact on the environment under 50 hectares, so for a proposed afforestation under 50 hectares, you are also mandated. In the vast, vast majority of cases, as the data shows, the Forest Service has been screening out as well for this, saying that there won't be a big problem. If you read the piece, if people read the piece, they'll see that this is a bit of an issue for conservation groups, but also legal experts we spoke to, because they're arguing, okay, individual conifer plantation sites might be 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 hectares, but if you're applying to put that into an area that already has 200 or 300 or 400 hectares, you should be taking those into account as well. the argument from the department has come back to us that yes, they are doing those assessments and taking that into account, but the experts would be arguing that maybe that's not been done appropriately in line with European law when you have so many other plantations already in the area that can have a cumulative impact.
Yeah, well, just to put, I mean, obviously I said go read the pieces, but put in some of the numbers that jump out, you know, 11% of Ireland is, you know, effectively forested, which is one third of what the EU average is. And of ours, you know, 50% of that is a crop in effect. You know,
I'd say the vast majority is seen as a crop. This is the way Irish forestry is generally viewed, because of that 11%, you're looking at maybe up to 2%, which is native woodland, or and then far, far lower for native or ancient native woodlands, which are essentially non-existent now. And actually, there was reports out recently that there might be in a deforestation position, which is really sad to see. And again, within that 11%, like I said at the start, we've got one of the highest rates of plantation forestry in Europe and the highest share of the forest area that is dominated by an introduced tree species, which is either conifer plantation or pine as well.
Here's the question, because I can hear people listening. Why should I care? I have written down 1, 2, 3, 4 concerns, but if you want to just give us an idea of why people should give a damn, that'd be very helpful.
Yeah, I think one of the issues that maybe I didn't cover there at the start is where these trees are being planted. So the big move to bump up our forestry rate or rate of planting came really in the 50s and 60s, which was very much a state-led project. Part of it obviously was increasing our tree cover, creating an indigenous timber industry, but also trying to keep rural economies going and keep people in parts of the country where there wasn't necessarily many other opportunities or farming wasn't that successful on what was seen as marginal land. The problem is the areas that were described as marginal land are now what we would really qualify as high nature value areas. So you're looking at semi-natural grassland, scrubland, heather, gorse areas, where you've got a lot of species, species-rich areas now, particularly as we've intensified agriculture in more productive areas, a lot of the species have been pushed into these marginal areas. Another big issue is, I guess, more, it's on the environmental, but also on the climate side, is that historically a lot of the planting has been on peat soils. Peat is our greatest carbon store in Ireland. And once you disturb the peat, that's thousands of years of carbon that's been stored up that is then being released. Once you disturb the peat, you're instantaneously losing carbon from that soil. The reason, if people don't know necessarily how the forestry model works, when you're putting in a plantation on peat, you will generally have to drain that. So you're taking the water off, you're introducing oxygen. All the biological material then is seeing oxygen potentially for the first time in hundreds or thousands of years. And then it starts to break down and you're getting an instantaneous release of carbon. And that's a big issue. Of course, the trees will take in a certain amount of carbon over time. That's the function of trees as well. And that's a big argument from the government for this, you know, large scale planting that we need. But the problem is with a conifer plantation, you're clear felling it in about 30 or 40 years. And then you're getting a release of carbon and you're replanting again. So the cycle sort of continues in that way. The other issue, sorry, if I can go on about it, is around peat, is a lot of the planting, as we particularly go into the second article, is in upland areas in the likes of, you know, Leitrim, Cavan, Donegal, all the way down to Kerry, really, parts where we're seeing that the land is more marginal for agricultural production, but a lot of peat soils as well. You see it here, I'm very close to the Wicklow Mountains, you have a lot of it there as well on the uplands. The drainage, a lot of the way it's cut, it's obviously to get the water off, in most cases, as quickly as possible. So then you have siltation, you have all this material coming off and the peat going into your water sources, which causes issues for the quality of water, but also for certain species. The freshwater pearl mussel, which is a keystone species in Ireland, like if people don't really care about it, they should care, because it's also important for salmon and other species, important for their survival as well. They need really high quality clear water. And this is peat plantation forestry has had a massive impact on their status as an endangered species. So there's a whole range. There's environmental, but also, I guess, in the second piece, what a lot of people have become concerned about is the social impact. You look at places like Leitrim, where you have nearly 20% of the county with forestry covered, the vast majority of that conifer plantations. So that's the highest rate. I think average across the country is around 11% or so, but it's obviously much lower. And there's massive social issues there. I mean, it's already a very rural county, very isolated people already. And they're finding that this is pushing them further apart. And there are arguments that, you know, I think a lot of people, particularly those who are maybe in favor of the current model we have said the situation isn't as bad as being portrayed as people. And there are arguments to be made there. I think there's always an element that some people just don't want certain projects or proposals going into their own backyard. But I went up there myself recently and spoke to some people who have plantations that are literally right up against their border, where in the countryside you might normally have your own hedgerow. Some people have forestry that is poking over their hedgerow and, you know, damaging it and coming in. And really, I mean, I think if you've seen one, you see that they're quite this dark green color all year round, and it does impact on people's mental health, and also impacts on the amount of light that gets onto your land. And it's having a big impact on people there.
It destroys biodiversity as well, the Sitka spruce plantations. There is nothing on the floor but pine needles. There are no secondary plants. There is no light getting through. So that's also very bad for the areas where they're overplanted.
Yeah, there is impacts there. I mean, there's obviously a level of biodiversity that any forestry will have. I think, you know, it's not going to completely rule out, but there are certain, like, you'll get a lot of foxes and hooded crows, and you will have certain birds, and raptors will use it to an extent. I mean, we go into it, I don't know if we'll have time to discuss later, but I find it very interesting about the hen harriers, that they will use the conifer plantation up to a certain extent, up to about 10 years. But then, like you're saying, Martin, once the canopy closes in, they can no longer use it. And it's actually having a massive impact on the hen harrier population decline in Ireland. There's definitely not as much biodiversity. There's studies out there that I've had argued to me that say you can have as much biodiversity, but a different type of biodiversity than in a native woodland. But yeah, definitely, I think the level isn't the same. The number of species that you would have isn't the same. And like you said, there are those impacts on, if you're talking about the impact on water quality, the impact on peat, taking the habitat from species like the hen harrier, who would, you know, who love semi-native grassland for foraging, who love heather for their nesting and for their foraging as well. And when that gets taken over by forestry, that has a big impact. On those species.
We've spoken now for nearly 20 minutes and we haven't even said monoculture yet. when you think about the idea of this cash crop, and, you know, the idea that it's farmed, and this is, as you said, it's the vast majority of our forestry, and then you only have to go back a couple of weeks and think of what we were referring to as Pippa Hackett's bill and the forestry bill, and the arguments that the environmental NGOs put forward about how it was going to make it more difficult to object to some of these plantations. Where do you stand on this, Niall? How do you find it?
That's kind of, it's one aspect, I suppose. We didn't go into the financial side of it too much because the focus was more on the biodiversity side, but we touched on a little at the end of the second article, because in the second piece that was out yesterday, we focused on the three individuals or groups who are bringing the vast, vast majority of appeals before the Forestry Appeals Committee. And I've kind of been associated, there's a lot of talk in the media, I'd say. I've seen a lot of quotes talking about vexatious appeals and that they're just trying to block the system and NIMBYism. And you'll see in the second article, we asked for a lot of lobbying records through Access to Information in the Environment, and that same sort of terminology is coming back from the forestry industry to the department as well. But when you actually examine the appeals cases, then you see that in many cases, they have been justified in the reasons for taking it, like for the environmental side of things. In particular, I think I can say Peter Sweetman is a very well-known environmental litigant in Ireland. He's been accused of bringing just cases for the fun of it to an extent. But when you actually look at his record, he's had some very big achievements in the European Court of Justice in particular that has actually very much directly influenced now the Forest Service and the department carrying out these or having to carry out these environmental assessments. But I mean, there's still almost 500 cases with the Forestry Appeals Committee to decide. I have the date up until I think the end of August, so it might have come down a little bit, but they had, there's about 80 almost where they cancelled the decision and over 150 where the decision was upheld. So it's not in every case, but even in the cases where the decision was upheld, on some cases that I looked through, the cases from 2020, the Forestry Appeals Committee did have some issue with the assessments being carried out. So a lot of them are legitimate. The concern is definitely legitimate, but now there are going to, obviously, like you said, changes to with the act that has now come in, changes to the fees. So there'll be an introduction of fees to bring an appeal to the committee, and also potentially to bring, if you want to make a submission or an observation to a license application, similar to the planning system. That's the whole idea, to bring it more in line. The problem is, you might have one planning permission in your area that your neighbor wants to put in something you don't like or you disagree with, or if there's maybe a quarry that's going in near you or whatever it might be. Usually that's one application. I think the argument that has been made, which I think is quite a fair argument by some, Neil Fuchs, who's also another person who's brought a lot of appeals, who spoke to us, made a very strong argument that he doesn't believe this fees process is going to be in line with European environmental legislation that says, you know, it cannot be prohibitively expensive for citizens to get engaged in environmental matters. The reason I think he has an argument to make there is you could be living in an area with 15 forestry applications that are coming in 1 month. It could be, for example, because there could be multiple felling licenses, there could be an afforestation license, there could be an application for a forest road, or you might live in one of the heavily forested areas and you could have applications for, you know, multiple forestry roads, again, multiple felling licenses at the one time. And if you have to pay 50, 100, 200, whatever it might be to appeal these, I think there might be an argument to make that's prohibitively expensive. If you look at, for example, in Quilcha, often put in over 100 felling license applications in one day. You know, usually it's in the hundreds. They'll put them all together. Now, they themselves have a fair argument to be made that they're trying to show the Forest Service that there might be a cumulative impact from all of their applications together. But it also opens up to that argument that maybe the fees is going to be making it too expensive for citizens and individuals and environmental groups to be making appeals to licenses that they don't believe have been appropriately assessed for their impact on biodiversity.
That sounds pretty dismal now. It sounds like it is pretty dismal. Apart from appeals or going to Europe, is there another way that people can change this system? Can we make political pressure work to change the department's outlook?
Yeah, it's a bit difficult to see because there's been a lot of, I mean, I've you know, worked with environmental groups before. I've been in environmental journalism for a number of years, and this is an issue that is coming up all the time that hasn't seen necessarily a huge amount of change until, you know, there was kind of that push when licenses started getting overturned and when it was actually been determined that, okay, maybe these haven't been carried out as appropriately as they could have been. And that sort of forced the hand, I think, for a long time. Even if you look at the second article in particular, we also look at that the forestry sector themselves were calling for changes. I mean, for a long time, particularly because there was only one ecologist in the Forest Service for a long, long time up until the start of this year. And the forestry industry themselves could see that that was going to be an issue coming down the line. But it's only now that more ecologists and more forestry inspectors and more staff have been hired. So I think it's a slow changing things. I think now the pressure, because it's coming from the environmental side, it's coming from community groups. You have this Save Leitrim group, you have Save Cavan, Save Kerry. There's a big network of community groups in areas that are heavily forested coming up now. And you have pressure from the forestry side as well, because, you know, you have to accept there are a lot of jobs that are going now because of this backlog. There is issues. There's going to have to be importation of timber. But from my research and what we looked at, everything that was coming back from all sides who were concerned is the administration from the Forest Service and from the Department of Agriculture was a big issue. And they've been, you know, they've been probably under-resourced for what they have to do as well. And I think I've often seen that a lot of these things always come back to the administrative side and the resourcing side that cause, let's say, decades-long backlogs, decades-long issues that aren't resolved. And then there's always one big thing now that sort of puts it all in front and center. So I think you can see by the speed that that bill went through, whether you agree with it or not, that things can change rapidly in this area. But there has to be, like you said, a pressure applied. And I think there is a significant amount of pressure. And now the fact that you have a Green Party minister who in charge of forestry, who, in fairness, Pippa Hackett has some very good ideas in terms of how forestry and farming have to be more closely aligned in terms of native planting and rewilding. Because you have to remember, the vast majority of forestry owners, at least at the principal stage, I know there's a certain level which you have investment now from pension funds and other things, but the majority of forestry is on farmland, and the majority of owners of the actual forestry are farmers themselves. So I think there's a great opportunity for a much closer aligning of that. And it's something we didn't go into in detail. We kind of focused on the bad stuff rather than the good stuff for this. And there is change coming. I think it's widely accepted that there needs to be a move more to what would be called continuous cover forestry, which is more normal to see in the likes of Germany and France for centuries, which is, instead of clear felling the entire crop as it is seen, you have a continuous cover forest. And what you do is you select particular timber within that forest to come down. So particular trees, when they reach a certain maturity, when they're a certain quality, you take them down and you analyze it in such a way that you allow growth for the other ones. And you pick in particular trees to come down and keep a continuous cover forest. There's a very small percentage in Ireland at the moment that is in continuous cover forestry, but I've spoken to a few foresters recently, including one who contacted me after the articles came out, to explain that they really do want to see this model progress in Ireland, because I can't personally, from the research, see another way it's going to work, because I think the clear fell model is reaching its end. I think people have seen maybe less the impacts of it on biodiversity. There's a social aspect of it now, which is gaining through those community groups. And I think on the environmental side of it, there's going to be continued to be appeals, because the three groups I spoke to, they're not going to stop appealing. I don't think that's the feedback I've received from them until they see a change in how the environmental impacts have been assessed and maybe a change of the model. So there's opportunities there, more agroforestry, continuous cover forestry, elements of rewilding. But I guess key to all that, sorry for going on for so long about it, but key to all this is rewarding farmers for protecting biodiversity and nature.
That was where we're going with this. If you're going to come to someone and you want to, we were talking before we came on air about the ideas behind just transition and what that means. So if you want someone to go away from a monoculture cash crop, that means clear felling, which is damaging the water table, the peatlands, the biodiversity, and then, you know, all of these other aspects, as I said, a double, triple, quadruple whammy, you're going to have to say to them, well, actually, the we're going to pay you to keep that carbon in the land. We're going to incentivize it in such a way, as whether it's tax incentives or other types of incentives, and we have to look at it and we have to be more clever about it. But it's clearly not the current model. Again, something you refer to as a vortex of inaction. I know it's a broader thing.
I didn't.
That was a quote. Yes, sorry, it's in the piece, and I happen to think it was a good piece. But but what I would say, Niall, just in terms of listeners, the idea, again, going back to how we look at our woodlands, how our forestry, and how we interact with them, that has to change. You know, the idea of walking into the Dublin Mountains and onto the Wicklow Way, and it all being this monoculture, we have to acknowledge that's not our natural or our native woodlands. You refer to the three groups who are the environmental NGOs, excuse me, now I keep struggling to get it. They're all under several umbrellas. What is the feeling with them in terms of the the public appetite for this conversation?
Yeah, I spoke with the likes for, of Birdwatch Ireland and the Irish Raptor Study Group and a few others who would be very much engaged in the forestry research and forestry policy side, because obviously a lot of raptors, particularly hen harriers, impacted. There are other groups. There's Native Woodland Trust. There's CRAN Ireland. There's Woodlands League. There's various environmental groups who are concerned with forestry, or tree cover, let's say, I think is a more, they prefer that term, I suppose, or woodlands. There is a big appetite. I think everyone's seeing with COVID now that people want spaces to go. Like, I'm very lucky here where I live. We have within 5 kilometers, we have what was traditionally a plantation beside a quarry. So that mightn't sound very good in essence when you combine the two, but it's now, you know, over the decades has actually been used as a public amenity. And I was just in there yesterday, and it's beautiful this time of year because you have a certain level of native species in there and planting. So I think people are enjoying and seeing that connection with nature more now during COVID. And we've really, I think there's a new desire for it. And you see big moves from Quilcha now, from Quilcha Nature. They have big plans for the West for replanting or allowing where they've planted previously with conifers on peatlands to return to the bogs themselves, allow that to regenerate it or to plant native woodland where possible. And there's obviously the regeneration project in the Dublin Mountains. So I think, yeah, there's good movements. The government has plans now. They're going to fund public authorities, public bodies, give them funding to plant native woodlands on their land that are open. And I think this is vital, especially if you look at areas of Dublin. If the councils were able to put in woodlands close to the centre of Dublin, so you're not just everyone pushed to the Phoenix Park. And yeah, I just think in general there's a bigger appetite now with COVID. People are reconnecting with nature, and I think with the whole climate crisis we're obviously facing into, there has to be a change. And I think it's fairly broadly recognized by the government. And another thing, I suppose, to be fair, is that, you know, with the environmental regulations or the rules in place for forestry in Ireland, I mean, you do have to have a certain level of broadleaf planting now. You have to leave a certain level of open spaces within conifer plantations. But again, that doesn't mean that this has to be the only model going forward. And I think there's an acceptance of that. If I can for a minute, sorry, to jump back to the farming thing. I find this topic really interesting. So, but it's a vital aspect is, and this is, it was a great, one of the academics I spoke to, an ecologist who specializes in high nature value farming, and who is very heavily involved in what I think is the future of results-based payments systems for farmers. I mean, there's fantastic schemes now for protection of the freshwater pearl mussel, for protection of the hen harrier, and they're showing quite, and you had obviously very good successful project in the Burren as well, that are showing, you know, how you great results that can be put in place when you actually reward farmers for doing the right things for nature. And in many cases for things they're already doing for nature on their farms, you're just actually paying them for that as opposed to penalizing them as you have under the current cap system, which is a whole other thing. We won't go there. I'll talk forever. But it was really fascinating what, it was James Moore, and he's in GMIT. What Dr. James Moore already told me is that you have this system for the forestry plantation where someone might say, okay, I want to plant on my land here. The Forest Service may come back to them and tell them, this is actually high nature value land. It's protected for certain species. It has, you know, rich rushes, whatever the sedges, whatever the actual biodiversity might be. So you can't plant here. But at the same time, they're not then told, here's some money to keep it this way. So you're telling them you're not going to give them these unbelievable premiums for forestry that are, you know, tax-free premiums and payments that are in place that are quite, you know, when the clearfell comes, it's quite a decent reward, and it's good to have for your pension, for example. And that's why a lot of the has been put in place. So you're telling them you can't have that, but you're also not giving them anything necessarily to keep a biodiversity rich area. And that's a big thing that has to change. You know, the premiums and payments for plantation forestry is so much better than for native woodland planting, for example, or to keep it as a high nature value farmland or grassland area. So that's something that dramatically has to change. The results-based payment systems are getting better, but there needs to be a lot more funding pushed into that, because a lot of it at the moment does rely on European funding, and which is great. It's the more funding you can get, the better. But I think that really has to be seen as the way forward. And if anyone followed the CAP, the Common Agricultural Policy negotiations, it doesn't look like it's turning necessarily exactly in the direction that people were hoping for biodiversity protections. We'll get better, but maybe not as ambitious as it needs to get to tackle the biodiversity and climate crises.
Well, in the long term, is it not cheaper to pay farmers than to pay fines? You know, is that not just the long term?
I think so. But again, it's one of those things that's off in the distance. And it's the same. I mean, if you look at the environmental assessments, a lot of people might go, oh, come on, what's wrong that they didn't go out in the field, they didn't assess it properly. I mean, there might only be a few species that use it at certain times of the year. What's going to be the big problem? I think you only have to look at Derry Brine and the 5 million fine and the continuous daily fines we have there for the landslide, and the fact that, you know, the European Court of Justice came down very heavily on us that a proper environmental impact assessment was not carried out at the time, and that the state failed to then remediate or do a remedial assessment afterwards. For whatever that advantage might be out of that, you can argue that after the facts of the case. But, you know, we're facing a big fine for that. But also the direct impact on farmland there, the direct impact on lake, on drinking water, on the road. So those are the sort of things that might come down the line. And I think there are issues when we talk about the likes of the curlew and the corn crake and the hen harrier, these species that, you know, I've never actually seen one. I've seen pictures, I've never seen one in a while, I wouldn't even know. But, you know, you have people I spoke to in Leitrim and other parts of the country, in Donegal and other areas for previous work, and, you know, they're like, that was a common thing to have these. I think when the last call is gone, people will realize the impact of some of the decisions we're making in land use in Ireland. One point, sorry, just on the land use, is that if I can speak positively of Eamon Ryan, I know that's not allowed anymore. But
no, we'll edit this out. Don't worry.
But he had, for several years now, and I've seen him talk about this, is he's really been pushing for an introduction of proper land use model and planning for Ireland. And that's really important. Now, I know there's work for a few years going on in the background now with a bunch of agencies, and we will hopefully have something by next year or 2022 latest, a proper plan for how we use and a proper model where we can see exactly the different types of soils, the different types of land, the different types of biodiversity we have in areas, and what works best for certain areas. Because I think everyone knows that the planning model in Ireland, the way it's currently designed, it's very much a developer-led model. And I think you have the same for the likes of forestry and aquaculture licensing and things like that, whereas we need something that's completely integrated, that's open to the public, that you can see all the information. And I'm looking forward to seeing that for forestry as well, because there is a model being developed now similar to the planning system, where you can view the applications, you can view the documents, because at the moment there's PDF files that go up on the department's website every Wednesday with very minimal information. And this has been accepted in documents we've seen from the department, that it's not, the system's not good enough, and that's why they're changing. But like that's another thing, if you read the two articles, is something that you will see as well, is that the information at the moment of forestry isn't necessarily there for the public that they can see for the license applications. You know, you get a number, you don't see the name of the company who's applying or who's going to do the work, or the individual like you would see with the planning system. You don't see a map of exactly where it is and what other planning is in the area. And I think for the public, that's one of the reasons why people get quite fearful as well about these things in their areas, when they don't have a level of transparency. And if I can say one more thing that we did, we actually, from the licenses that we pulled out through AIE, we put them all up into an online database so people can search through these 17,000 plus afforestation licenses to see, you know, what applications and what has been accepted in their local area, because I think that's a resource people really need. And if there is a level of transparency, which I really hope is coming with this new online viewer from the Forest Service, that the more informed choices people can make to determine, okay, do I need to have concern about this license application for forestry or not?
I have to say, Eamon did give your your pieces of tweet out.
Comments went a little nasty after that.
Yeah, but it's nice to see that you're as a real person doing real investigative journalism, that you get a tweet out from one of the leaders. If the rest of our leaders were so good at tweeting out genuine, real people with real investigative skills, we could be in a lot better place. But thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us.
Niall, people can see it on the pieces are up on Noteworthy now. Just also consider the work that Noteworthy do, folks. It's similar to what we have to do ourselves. We got to do all that promotion to get that work done, because if people don't put their hands in their pockets, the stories don't materialize. Thanks for talking to us again today, Niall. It's so clear that you know the topic inside out, and we really appreciate it. And we have to say
the articles are not as boring as I described, so they are a bit more colourful on the technical stuff.
And yeah, no, we have to say something negative about Eamon Ryan now. Sleepy Eamon Ryan. Talk to you all soon, folks. Bye bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe.